This message this morning is definitely PG-13, okay? It's 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and it is, unless you want to answer a lot of questions on the drive back home from some of your little ones, this might be a time to let them go to the Sunday school, although it's up to you. Going to have the discussion sooner or later. Before we look into 1 Corinthians 7, however, I would like you to turn with me to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11, where there's a verse, very famous verse, it's verse 6 of Hebrews 11, a classic statement of faith. Hebrews 11, and beginning in verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please him, the Lord. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. The reason this is a classic statement is because a lot of people simply have fuzzy ideas about the Lord. They know he's there, but they don't seek him. And the reason they don't seek him very often is because they don't realize just how worthwhile it is to do so, to come to know the Lord. When you give your life to the Lord, we are shocked to find, at least I was, that he actually takes it. I mean, I knew that I wanted him to, but I was unsure of just how firm a grip he would take, and he took a very firm grip. I realized I really belonged to him, and some things began to transpire. He actually benefits and strengthens us. The changes that he brings about when we give our lives to him are radical, deep, profound changes, and almost invariably, in fact, invariably, they are always improvements if he's the one that's bringing them about. So let me see a show of hands, those of you who are Christians. If you came to Christ and noticed that he changed your life for the better, and you saw it tangibly, raise your hand. Yeah, see? I mean, every group that I talk to and then I ask that question, it's amazing. And we don't take the time to think it through. What a great improvement the Lord has made. I mean, it sounds trite to say it that way, but the fact is, it's worth it to come to him. It's worth it to give your life to Christ, to come to know the Lord. When he does this, he reaches deep down inside and takes over in areas sometimes that we would not have thought that he would do. He doesn't really leave any closed or locked doors in our life. If your life is like a house and you let him in, that's the way it was when I let the Lord into my life. It was like a house, you know, and I let him in, but I had prepared the living room for him. And he said, thank you. And he walked straight through to the first locked door he could find and said, what's behind here? I had no idea how nosy he would be. Nor did I have any idea how much healing and strength it would come by just letting him in to all those areas. You know, you don't want to give him the key to something in your life. He stands there at that door. Well, I got news for you. He doesn't really need the key, and he can just get right in. It's just as well to let him, because he brings so much healing, so much truth, so much wisdom into your life. And he comes into the areas of our lives that are extremely private, areas that we would consider to be entirely our property and only our property. Notably, our sex life. He moves right straight into it. Now I have your attention. Some of you guys just looked up at me for the first time. That's great. Huh? What? It's true. What happens is we find out that he is deeply involved, radically involved with every area of our lives, including our sex life. And a lot of people, when they think of being a Christian, they think of the church, they get the wrong idea about the Lord. They kind of have the idea that if God put up with sex at all, it was only as a way to make babies. And afterward, he probably thought it was a mistake, but by that time, it was too late. The plumbing was already installed, and this is the way it has to be. But I'm sure he's not involved at any other level. It's just like, grit your teeth and get through it, and then have babies, and that's it. And it might interest you to know that that's actually a doctrinal position in a huge wing of the Christian community. A huge wing of the Christian community sees sexuality, the only justification for sexuality in this wing of the community is procreation. And if there is no procreation, then there cannot be sex, even in marriage. And people have this idea. This stems clear back from the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and 5th century in the early church because of two huge cults, Manichaeism and Neoplatonism, which we don't have time to talk about. But they were very powerful cults, and people got saved out of those cults, and you bring your baggage with you into your Christian faith, and many of them became teachers, and they came with that idea that if something is physical, it is bad, and it doesn't get any more physical than sex. Sex is really physical. And so they thought, well, this must not be a good thing. And they misinterpreted a huge amount of the scriptures, but there are some passages which, if you see them in that light, in the wrong light, it does appear that they would agree with these cults that anything physical is bad. The church adopted this, and that is why, by the way, celibacy was enjoined on huge numbers of people, and the idea that the celibate life is somehow holier than the married life. The passage we're going to look at this morning in 1 Corinthians in just a moment is actually one of the passages, one of the key passages, misinterpreted in order to come up with that idea. But also, another thing happened in the church as a result of this, and that is the great debate over contraception. To this day, in a huge portion of the church, there's a big debate over whether people should use contraception. And in Roman Catholicism, it is considered wrong. And the reason is the theological position that procreation is the only legitimate reason for sexuality. And if you use a contraceptive, then the reason is recreational sex. And that's not procreation, and so that's not right. And that's why there's a debate to this day, because not all Catholics believe that that's correct, but that's the debate. That's the root of it in Catholicism today. Many Christians within the Catholic communion are debating it even right now and have been for generations. But it stems from thinking that started so long ago, and it is a misinterpretation. People think to themselves, my goodness, God could not. I mean, sex is not something that he would want to know about. But what the Bible teaches is that he actually invented it, created it, likes it, is very aware of it. Some of you are thinking, oh my goodness. You mean when we thought we were alone, he was aware of this? For the first time in your whole life, you're thinking this. For the first time, realizing, oh my goodness, if I'd known the Lord was anywhere near, I wouldn't have done that. I want you to understand something. Scripture's very clear that God is very positive about sexuality. And just to show you how positive, I want you to turn to Proverbs before we'll get to Corinthians. But it's a short passage in Corinthians, so I got to give you some other material here. Proverbs chapter 5. Now, Proverbs 5 is about sex. The first 14 verses is about immorality, which we talked about last week. It's fire outside the fireplace, okay? And how dangerous it is, and he makes it very clear. But beginning in verse 15, he starts talking about fire in the fireplace, and baby, he means to turn it up. Look at what it says in verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. See, the poetry is obvious. You know what he's talking about. But if you don't know, you're going to figure it out real quick. Verse 16, should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. Now, there is nothing in here about grinning and bearing and putting up with sexuality and only using it for procreation. This is something that was designed to be pleasurable and enhancing to the marital relationship. That's what he's talking about. And he's contrasting it with the immorality, which is so dangerous outside of the marriage bond. And then he says in verses 19 and 20, should there be any doubt about what he's getting at, as a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated, intoxicated is the Hebrew concept, always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? A man's ways are before the Lord, and so on. Now, some of you were thinking, I can't believe you read that out loud in church. And there are some passages that, you know, we just shouldn't read in church. Well, my friend, if that's the case, you're in the wrong church, for one thing. But the church has just gotten too churchy for the Lord, and that's a very dangerous thing. If we can't read any old passage and see what he says. Fact is, he's very straightforward about sexuality. In Genesis chapter 2, he says, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, shall cleave to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. It is a distinct reference to sex. Paul reads it that way as he quotes it in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians. And there's no question that the Lord is in favor of it, mightily in favor of it. Now let's have a look at 1 Corinthians, because the Corinthians had a bit of a problem with this. Their problem was that in their culture, they had imported a bunch of baggage about sexuality. Part of the baggage had to do with the real lax attitude on the one hand to sex, and we saw that in chapter 6. And I want to just review that a little bit because it really sets the stage for chapter 7. Paul, remember, this is all one letter. He's talking to these people about things that matter in discipleship, and he's made it very clear that sexuality matters in discipleship, and it shouldn't be used the wrong way. And he's going to get into the subject that it should be used the right way in just a moment. But have a look at what they were dealing with. If you weren't here last week, you might want to get the CD or the tape from last week because it's important. It goes with what we're going to say this morning. But they had a problem in that some of the people in the church were actually saying that it would be okay for men to use prostitutes in Corinth. Now, prostitution in the Roman Empire was rampant. It was considered relatively socially acceptable. I say that, relatively socially acceptable. It's one of those things that, it's probably not great, but it's okay, and it's always been there, and so on. And that was imported into the church. So there were some people who got saved and had came to Christ, and they were walking with the Lord, but they were still thinking, you know, it'd be okay, because I was raised. I, my father, my grandfather, they all used prostitutes. It shouldn't be a problem. When Paul says it is a big problem, immorality, sexuality outside of heterosexual monogamous marriage is a big problem. And what he says is in verses 12 to 20 of chapter 6, and he uses a couple of their little slogans to kind of go back on them. Verse 12, he says, all things are lawful for me. That's one of their slogans. They said, well, all things are lawful. It's okay. And Paul says, well, not all things are good for you. And furthermore, I won't be mastered or overpowered by any of them. Another slogan, verse 13, food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food. And they were associating this with sex. It's just biology. And Paul says four things in this little section, and we saw it last week, but in terms of the immorality of the world that the Corinthians, some of them, were confused on. He says four things. It's more than biology. Your slogans are deceiving you. And I want you to remember the concept of a slogan because there's another one in chapter 7. Very important to understand. He says, your slogans are deceiving you. There's a kernel of truth in there, but it's not true the way you think it is. It's not true the way you're applying it. See? And secondly, it's addicting. The immorality is addicting. Verse 12, he said, I won't be overpowered by anything. And sex outside of marriage just has no end to it. It takes more and more of your life. And it's addicting. And third, it's suicidal. Verse 18, you're sinning against yourself. If you remember from last week, I spent a bit of time talking about that. It is very counterproductive for your own life to have sexual intimacy with a person you're not lifelong connected to in marriage. And he makes that very clear. And then the fourth thing is it's a misuse of God's property. That's his logic. Verses 19 to 20, you belong to God. Your body belongs to God. Now, he's talking to Christians, of course. This is in-house. This is the family of God. And he's saying, your body doesn't belong to you. And your sex life doesn't really belong to you. It belongs to God. And some people went out from last week with stooped shoulders. You know, and it's a funny thing because afterwards, the prayer folks that do the prayer ministry up here, a couple of them came to me and they said, well, way to shoot the prayer ministry in the foot. You invited people to come up and pray about their sex life, and what do you know? Nobody came. Well, of course not. You know, everybody's embarrassed to come up. But I saw a lot of stooped shoulders leaving, and I got some comments in between. That's where things really kind of get hot during the week after I, you know. It's like reading the reviews. You know, every once in a while, people will get back to me on email about what they thought about what was said on Sunday morning. And I had more than one comment about folks who came away feeling so bad. It's like, oh my goodness, I am absolutely sold out to sin. And the reason is because they were thinking about sex all the time. Now, I know that's probably not true for any of you. And judging by the look on your faces, not me, Pastor Rick. But, you know, these folks admitted that this was the case and said that, you know, I just feel terrible because this is on my mind a lot. And I said, oh, no. Come out. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. I'm being facetious. And they kind of, I don't know if they expected me to. But you get to the end of this section and you can see why people would think, well, then maybe sex was a bad idea. And even the Lord thinks it was a bad idea. And the only way to contain it is to keep it in marriage, kind of like put the clamps on it. That's the only thing. And then even in marriage, it should not be entered into for any kind of pleasurable reason or intimacy reason at all. Not to enhance the marriage itself. It's only good for making babies. And as we saw in Proverbs, that's not the case. And Paul now, in chapter 7, the first 7 verses, takes to task another group of people who have their own slogan. See, the thing about living in the world is that there's usually extremes about everything. And on the one hand, you had the libertines who were saying, well, you know, sexuality is great. It's just physical. Let's do it. And Paul says, no, you got the wrong idea. And then you got a bunch of folks who were ascetics. An ascetic is a person. Now, there's a good asceticism. Don't get me wrong. There is a good tradition within the Christian church of self-discipline that can be called asceticism. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Greek asceticism, in which anything physical is evil, like I mentioned. And people come at it from the standpoint of saying, my physical body should not have any pleasure, so I will keep all pleasure away from it, and that will make me more holy. That'll make me closer to God. And there were folks like that in the Corinthian church. And what happened is that they were thinking that even in marriage, it would be better not to have sex, not to have a sexual relationship. And they figured, you know, if he says not to do it outside of marriage, then if we don't do it inside of marriage, that'll really impress the Lord. You know, it's amazing how many times in church history you find people who tried to impress God with how holy they were by adding stuff to the scriptures that he doesn't say and by reinterpreting what he did say. This was a huge problem all through church history, and especially second to the fifth centuries, a lot of material like this. Well, Paul sees it clear back here. And there was an ascetic group that were saying, you know, maybe even in marriage we shouldn't have a sexual relationship. And that's what he deals with. Chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. Now concerning the things about which you wrote. Now see, they had written to him, by the way, and you'll see this phrase again and again from here on in the letter. He had written to them, they had written to him, and they had some arguments about it, as a matter of fact. They did not always take what he said. Some of their frustration with him was that he said things they didn't want to hear. But he's writing back now. They had written him a letter, and they had put forth this idea. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, the word touch is actually the Greek word that's there. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. The NIV renders it, it's good for a man not to marry. But the word marry is not in the original. The implication is, but the word is not there, the word touch a woman actually simply is a euphemism for sexual relationship. And so some renderings, so the ESV, for instance, will say it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. And NIV says it's good for a man not to marry. And NAS says the actual literal rendering, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. They all refer to the same thing. But here's what I want you to do. Now, follow me very carefully here, please, because a misunderstanding of this line in this part of this chapter will change how you interpret the rest of the chapter. It's very important to understand this. I want you to put quotation marks around the phrase, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. or whatever phrase it is in your translation, put quotation marks around it, because this, in all probability, was one of their slogans. And what that means is, for those of you who do exposition and you do Bible study, what that means is that Paul is not saying that he's saying this. What he's saying is they're saying this. And what he's going to do is the same thing he did with their other slogans. He's going to say, look, there's a kernel of truth here, but you're misapplying it. Now grasp this, please, because it makes sense of everything else he says in the chapter. They were ascetic in the sense of saying, look, it is more holy to be celibate even in marriage than it is to be married and have an active sex life. They're implying that. And this, as I mentioned, when it's misinterpreted, gives rise to all kinds of misunderstandings concerning marriage, that it's some sort of second-rate life and that the really holy person remains celibate. That's why celibacy was so popular among the folks who considered themselves so holy for hundreds, even thousands of years in church history. And so what he's saying is that concerning the things about which you wrote to me, this phrase, it is good for a man not to have sexual relationships with a woman, let me explain something. He goes on. By the way, if some of you are looking at this and you're wondering, and you do exposition, I'd be more than happy to talk with you about the text after church or anytime. Anybody who does that, feel free to talk to me about it. There are reasons why this is this way. And I, at one time, had held a different position, but I've changed my position on it. I'm convinced that this really is one of their slogans. But if you have questions and you do theology and that sort of thing, I'd be more than happy to talk to you about it. So he says, look, this is one of your little slogans. You're misinterpreting something. Verse 2, he says, because of the immorality of our world, let each man have his own wife. Emphasis is on having her, and he means sexually. And let each woman have her own husband. He wants them to have this relationship. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife. Likewise, also the wife to her husband. That word duty means to owe something to someone. It's like borrowing money and paying it back or not paying it back. It means you owe it to them. And notice it is completely reciprocal. Both of them owe it to the other person. Now, he's going to develop this. Verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. It's very interesting because a lot of people would say, well, no, I don't have authority over my own body. The Lord does. Well, that's true, but if you're married, so does somebody else. And it's interesting, too, because the church has a reputation for only believing the first half of verse 4. The wife doesn't have authority over her own body, the husband does. So people read that and they go, oh, it's a big sexist group, but a boys club down there, ribble rubble, you know, it's terrible. And actually, he turns it right around and says the exact opposite as well. He says, and likewise also husband. The husband does not have authority over his own body. The wife does. You say, well, how does that work? I mean, if you really have authority over each other's bodies, how does that really work in the sexual relationship? I mean, well, it only works in one way, absolute mutuality. And that means serving the other person. That's what he's getting at, is serving the other person. He's emphasizing here the ongoing relationship, verse 2, owing it to each other, verse 3 and verse 4, a completely mutual obligation. Bottom line here is that sex is about your partner. It's about your partner, your married partner. It's really for them. If you're a woman, your sex life is about your husband. If you're a man, your sex life is really about your wife, honest and truly. It's not about you. Oftentimes, men mistake this. Now, I am going to offend equally this morning, I promise you, okay? I always want to make sure I do that. But this is a situation in which sometimes men don't see the reality of it in their sex life with their wife. And they don't realize that it's really for her, not just for them. Although they have a real strong sex drive, God created them that way. He said, be fruitful and multiply. And the guy said, okay, I'm in charge of that. I'll take care of that. We'll make sure we do that. And they've been doing it ever since. And that's true. It's an old saying about an elderly lady speaking to her young daughter. And the young daughter was complaining about her husband. And she said, my husband can never take a hint. And the older lady said, well, honey, if men could take a hint, there'd be no children in the world. That's an interesting comment on that. So the issue is that the men oftentimes feel very strongly on the inside, well, you know, I'm interested in a little physical attraction here. And the ladies sometimes are not. And here's what will happen. Guy's thinking, this is kind of for me. He's been thinking about her all day. This is a classic scenario. He's been thinking about her all day. He's been at work, and he's been thinking about her. And I don't want to embarrass anybody, but she's probably not wearing hardly anything in his mind as he's thinking about his wife. And he's on his way home, and he's thinking about more and more about her. And he gets home, and he walks in, and there she is. And she has not been thinking about him all day. And she may have been at work and or at the house and taking care and of the kids or whatever she's doing, and she's tired, and it's been a long day. And he walks in, and he comes up behind her, gives her a little squeeze, a little hug. Hey, baby. And she turns around. She looks at him and says, what are you thinking? Is that all you ever think about? And he says, I'm rejected. Oh, no. And she points to child number four with the dirty diaper and the runny nose and says, take care of that. Don't talk to me about being, you know, intimate. I don't want to get away from it. And he gets upset. Well, see, here's the deal. It's a matter of timing. If it's really about her, guys, you got to tell yourself that on your way home. It's really about her. I remember years ago when I was a kid, I was a high school kid, and I worked in a gas station. And the guy who owned the station was, at the time, a rank pagan. But his manager was a really wonderful Christian man. And he was about 10 years older than the rest of us kids who worked there. And he'd been married for a few years. And one day he came in with a box of chocolates in a heart box. And it was not Valentine's. And we all questioned him. Here's a bunch of young guys going, what are you doing with the chocolates? And he just looked at us and he said, I'm going home. And we all learned a really good lesson. He's a man who's thinking ahead. You know, he's not just thinking about himself. And that's important. It's crucial that what Paul says here be understood. Sexuality is for the other person, and the authority belongs to the other person, as difficult as that is. So then he says in verse 5, so stop depriving one another. Now that can be rendered either way. It can be rendered stop depriving, or it can be rendered don't deprive, either way. But there were apparently some people already doing it for what they considered was very spiritual reasons, because look what he says, stop depriving one another, except by agreement, both of you agreeing, for a time, short time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, if that's what you want to do, and you're going to abstain from a sexual relationship in marriage for a short period of time, okay, if you're going to do it for spiritual reasons. But then he says, come together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control. He's very serious about that satanic temptation, very serious about it. And this is read too quickly by people. They don't realize that what Paul is saying is, do not interrupt your sex life as a married couple, or one or both of you will be put in undue temptation, and the enemy's looking for an opportunity to do that. That's what he's saying. And then he says in verse 6, now I'm telling you this by way of concession, not of command. What does he mean by that? Some people think, and I used to think, he means, look, you can get married if you need to. But I don't think that's what he's saying. The concession isn't referring to marriage. The concession is referring to the idea of abstaining sexually for a short period of time. He says, if you want to, you can, but you don't have to, and I'm not commanding you to. And if you do abstain sexually after being married, if you start trying to live some sort of celibate life in marriage, he says you're going to actually put the other person in undue temptation, and it will become extremely difficult for them. And that is something that that will be as much your fault as theirs. Now, I know that there are no excuses for immorality, but there are some reasons when you look back at it and you say to yourself, you know, what were the dynamics that went into the fall of that person into an immoral lifestyle? Sometimes the dynamics include an ignorance of this particular principle in marriage right here that Paul's getting at, and it's very serious. I came across a true story about a pastor's wife. She came in for counseling. And the counselor, Christian counselor, he wrote a book in which he told her story. And she was weeping, sobbing. Her husband had done the classic thing, run away with the church secretary is what happened. After 23 years of marriage and pastoral ministry together, he left his wife and ran away with this other woman. And so this is the dialogue as she talks to her counselor about this. She says this about their marriage. She says, "We haven't touched each other for 2 years. Almost literally, certainly we haven't had any sexual relationship, but we actually hardly ever touch, at least not intentionally," she says. "When my husband evidenced apparently no desire to show affection or any need for it, I assumed that he was just that kind and that those things didn't interest him and weren't necessary. So I didn't push it, and I kind of stayed out of his way. I was never taught that these things are important to a man." "Well, how did your husband get involved with this other woman?" the counselor asks. "Well, she offered to do some volunteer work in the church office. We didn't know her too well, but we needed the help, and we wondered a time or two if we should keep her since she dressed in an obviously sensual way. I felt that she'd be no temptation to him since he wasn't interested in affection." By now, this lady is sobbing in the counselor's office. He says, "What happened?" She says, "Oh, how blind I was, how mistaken. She would make a special point to be in his office for every little excuse, and she kidded him and touched him playfully. And well, something came alive in him, I guess. He became a different man. And that's when he told me that he didn't love me anymore and was going to leave the ministry and move in with her. It was unbelievable." And it does seem unbelievable until you realize these people, for all their ministry work, never paid attention to what Paul says here. Neither of them did. Neither of them paid attention to it in this particular case. It's not always women who don't want to have sex. We'll talk about that in a minute. But a lot of times it's men too. It's just it's a kind of a laziness that sets in, and Paul says you just simply mustn't let that happen. You mustn't let it happen. People sometimes just need to be touched. And if someone just touches them, it is amazing what is awakened, because they live a life in which they're never held. They're never touched. So there's a story of a couple who was at gunpoint, robbed. And when the thief said, "Is that all you have?" the lady said, "Well, if you'll frisk me again, I'll write you a check." Now, some of you are thinking, I can't believe he told that joke on a Sunday morning. I know. I know it's a shock. It's a terrible shock. But I've noticed that nobody's been sleeping during this message. Okay. Sometimes people just need to be touched, just to be held. And to not do it puts the spouse in a very, very dangerous situation. Listen to this quote. "The instinct of fidelity is perhaps the deepest instinct in the great complex that we call sex. The instinct for fidelity is the strongest instinct in the sexual drive," according to this researcher. "Where there is real sex, there is the underlying passion for fidelity." Emphasis on real, not faked, not just grin and bear it, but real sexuality, real intimacy. There is an instinct that goes with that is for fidelity, believe it or not. And that's what Paul is emphasizing here. Crucial aspect. Then he goes on, verse 7, and he says, "Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." What is he talking about? Well, he was probably single. In fact, he was single. We know. By the time he wrote this, he was. And he's saying it would be easier if you had the gift of being single. That's why he emphasizes the giftedness of singleness. Now, I want you to bear this in mind. I want you to please understand what Paul is doing. He comes from a culture in which it was terrible to not be married. The Jewish culture was terrible to not be married. To be single was not good, which is why we know he probably was married at some point. And now, either his wife had died, or more likely, she left him. He would have married a Pharisee, or into a Pharisee family, and she would have left him under the approval of her family when he came to Christ. So chances are that's what happened. But at any rate, he's single now. Now, you're going to see in this chapter, if you read ahead, what you'll find is that he wants to walk this, sort of this tightrope, explaining singleness is a gift and it is a good thing, against some of the tradition of his Jewish heritage. On the other hand, he wants the ascetics in Corinth to know marriage is also a gift and it is a good thing. And he wants to be right in the middle on this. He wants to make it clear. So understand, that's where he's going with it. And he says, look at verse 7, I wish that all men were even as I myself am, meaning single. However, everybody has their own gift. And apparently he's saying, I have this gift. I can do this. And it makes life simpler for me. He's going to explain why. Not because sex is wrong. Not because marriage is some sort of concession to the evils of the sex drive. No, he says later in the chapter, he says, no, it's easier because in our time and in this era and in the time I'm ministering, it would be very hard to take my wife with me. I mean, he goes wherever he goes, he gets beat up and thrown out of town. This can't be good for your marriage. So he's kind of says it's simpler, it's easier, you don't have to worry about as many things. That's where he's going. But it's not because sex is evil. Now, what does all this mean to you and me? Well, let's back up here. I want to mention a couple of things, and there's some subheadings for note takers, and we'll see kind of what's going on, practically speaking. It's pretty obvious what he's getting at once you really read through it and have a look at it. But I want to put two thoughts into your mind. Here's the first one, and there's three things under it. First is this. If you want to be serious about your discipleship to Jesus Christ, then get serious about your sex life. Isn't that a weird thing for a guy to say on a Sunday morning, pastor, you know? And I'm not saying be serious about not having sex without a married partner. That you already know. I'm talking about be serious about it in every way and understand that it means a lot to the Lord. If you're serious, you say, well, I'm a disciple. I've come to the Lord, you know, and I know that it means a lot to come to the Lord. Well, then get serious about your sex life because he's very serious about it and it has a real impact on your discipleship. It's important. Now, there's three things to note about this, and the first is this. Realize, if you're serious about your sex life, realize you are a sexual creature and God made you that way, and that's okay. In fact, it's better than okay. He likes that idea. He likes the idea that he made you with the capacity to have sex and that you have sexual desires. It's not wrong to have the desires. This is where the church went wrong in reinterpreting what Paul said. Paul never says those desires are wrong. You can use them wrongly. And the world, fire outside the fireplace thing, it's like a forest fire out there. They're going, fireplace? What fireplace? We got a forest fire. That's the way the world deals with it. But as a Christian, so many Christians just dwell under guilt. It's like some of the folks I talked to in between these two messages, just dwelling under guilt all the time because they feel bad every time they realize that they have sexual desires. They feel terrible about it. My friend, God created you that way. And I'm talking about heterosexuality here, not homosexuality. That's a whole nother story. And don't use this argument in that case. And if you have a wondering about it, talk to me afterwards. But I think I'm talking to a group of people who understands what I'm saying here. You were created as a sexual being. It's totally acceptable for you to understand that and to accept yourself that way and not see it as some horrible curse. And yet a lot of people do. Even in circles that ought to know better. They just feel guilty 24/7, constantly, over the issue. Don't let that happen. You were created in God's image with a sex drive. Sometimes I tell young guys, you know, because they always want to know, that if they want to walk with God, they always want to know, well, how am I supposed to handle my sex drive? It's this huge thing inside of me, and I don't know what to do with it. And I say, you know, it's like a gigantic horse that God gave you, and you got to learn to ride it. If you let it drive you, you'll be hurt. But God will give you grace, and you need to understand that it's okay and that it's something that belongs to God. It really is painful for men, and this needs to be understood. It's painful for women too, but it is sometimes very painful for men to realize that this huge drive is on the inside, and sometimes no legitimate way to deal with it. And even when they have a legitimate way to deal with it, It's not working. It's not working for them. That brings us to the second of these, and I'm not going to belabor this, but under this main heading, if you want to be serious about the Lord, be serious about your sex life. Number one is you're created sexual, and it's okay. That's a good thing in and of itself. Number two is if you're unmarried, then you have to find enough accountability in your own heart to not engage in a sexual relationship outside of marriage. And that's why Paul says, get married. He tells him to get married. But if you're single, he says, pray for the gift to remain single and not have a sexual relationship outside of marriage. We talked about that last week. Third thing is this, as a married person, understanding that if you're serious about your sex life, or serious about your discipleship, you should be serious about your sex life. As a married person, the pointer is this, be active in it, get better at it, cultivate it, practice. It's cheap fun. I can't believe I'm saying this stuff. I mean, can't believe it. Honest and truly, what does it cost you? Nothing. And people say, well, just, you know, I'm just not very good at that. Well, practice makes perfect, honey. Listen, there's a great book out by Dr. Laura. I kid you not. Do not whine to me about Dr. Laura. Buy the book. It's called Proper Care and Feeding of Husbands. Buy it and read it. Gentlemen, buy it for your wife. Leave it on the coffee table. She's been doing that for years with you, buying books and leaving them out for you to read. Buy it. Leave it out for her. Great book by Dr. Laura. And he, in Dr. Laura's book, she quotes a man who calls himself Herb, and he's quoting his wife. Now listen to what his wife says. Sex is to a husband what conversation is to a wife, says this woman. When a wife deprives her husband of sex for days, even weeks on end, it is tantamount to his refusing to talk to her for days and weeks on end. Think of it that way, wives, and realize what a deleterious impact enforced sexual abstinence has on a good man who is determined to remain faithful. I cannot stress that enough. In marital counseling, the number one complaint of men in Christian marriage against their wives is that their wives don't want to have sex with them. Now, I know that there's all kinds of abuse, and this doesn't cover everybody, but I'm telling you, when it comes to marital counseling, that's the number one deal among men. Most men simply suffer in silence for years because it's not manly to whine about it. And they don't want to be rejected anymore, and so they simply don't bring it up. But I guarantee you, it's a problem, a major problem. And very often when you have women who say, well, my marriage just isn't working, they come in for marital counseling. You find this as part of the dysfunction of the marriage. And there's always two sides to everything. And I don't want to seem uncompassionate about the two sides to these things. But I'm here to teach this passage. And what this passage says is, pay attention, and especially, ladies, pay attention to your husband, frankly. I mean, when Schlesinger wrote this book, it's amazing the number of quotes and just calls flooding in, letters flooding in from men all over the country, saying, finally, somebody telling it like it is on behalf of men. We live in a male-bashing culture in which so often, if you're female, you can say anything bad you want about men. And it's really terribly unchristian. It's terribly unbiblical. And oftentimes in marriage, the whole idea of the male sex drive is simply not dealt with at all by Christian women. So even though Laura Schlesinger is not an evangelical Christian, she's a converted Jew, but she has a lot of wisdom in that little book, and I recommend it. If you are married, you need to work on your sex life. And let me give you some straight advice. On your way home today, if the kids aren't in the back seat eavesdropping, ask. Just ask. It's amazing the number of couples don't even talk about it. They don't talk about it. They're embarrassed for one reason, don't want to discuss it. And if it's not working, say so and pray about it. That's another thing people never prepare. How could we pray about that? God doesn't even know we're doing it, does he? And if he does, oh, good grief. Now I really can't do it. See, that's what I want you to get over. It's a different kind of message this morning, I realize. But it's practical. It's practical. Remember, if you're serious about the Lord, get serious about your sex life. As a Christian couple, you should be often sexually intimate. People say, how often? Ask the men. They'll tell you. The average guy would look for sex anywhere from 2 to 4 times a week and wouldn't complain about every day a lot of times. Now, that's something you might not hear from your typical pulpit, but you heard it here, so there you go. A little bit of practical instruction. Get better at it. Work on it. Say, well, okay, it's part of my discipleship. Yeah, it is part of your discipleship. Pray it through, talk it through, get some help if it's not working. And this is all assuming, of course, that other factors are not a part of this that prevent. But under normal circumstances, it ought to be that way. It'd solve an awful lot of problems. Now, here's the second thing. Now, we're second major heading now. First one, if you want to be serious about the Lord, get serious about your sex life. Realize you are sexual, and that is okay. If you're unmarried, do not get into a sexual relationship. If you are married, get into it and enjoy it and learn how and make it work and ask the Lord. He'll help you. But here's another major heading. If you want to be free in your discipleship, now we're backing away just from sexuality. I want to talk now about the whole world itself and how we relate to the physical world. If you want to be free in your discipleship and you really want to be wise in it, then understand this. Realize that God embraces the mundane. Mundane. It means the world. It comes from a Latin term, which is mundus. It means world. And I looked it up in John 3:16 in the Latin Vulgate. It uses the word mundum, meaning world. God so loved the mundum, the world. But you know, when I use the word mundane, most of you thought to yourself, oh, well, that's just daily. Mundane means daily, boring. It's not important. It's physical. Life is messy. Life is not neat and clean and Sunday morning dressed up. True. Does God love all parts of physical life? Yes, He created it. And when you are redeemed, that's why when we started this morning, I mentioned when you're redeemed, every part of you is redeemed. Your whole life is redeemed. Your whole physical life, and God actually likes it. And He was not ashamed to come and be one of us and face sexual temptation, by the way. It says in Hebrews that Jesus was tempted in all points, just like we are. So He was not embarrassed to come. He was not embarrassed to be physical and real. God embraces the mundane. And here's what I mean by this, and here's how I think it applies. Now, we're not just talking about sex, although that's the deepest physicality that there is. But if that's true, then that means that He actually redeems just the fact that you can enjoy a good meal. You can enjoy a good life. You can enjoy the good things that God has done in your life. And He's done a lot of good things in your life. He's given you places to live and things to enjoy. And a lot of Christians live sort of half guilty all the time, low-level guilt, thinking, oh my goodness, I enjoyed that. Must have been wrong. And that comes from that false thinking that dates way back when, that it is more spiritual to live a life of anguish than it is to enjoy the physical life that God gives us. My friend, there's plenty of grief around. You want to grieve? You can have plenty of opportunity. But if you've got some time now to rejoice in the good things God has done, rejoice in them and enjoy the life that God has given you. This baptized in lemon juice thing that Christians go through, the holier they get, the angrier they look. The joy of the Lord is my strength. I'm really holy because I hate my life. I can hardly wait to die. Oh boy, this feels good. Thank you, Lord. You know, you hang around with people like that, you want to die just to get away from them. That is not the way to live the Christian life. There's, like I said, you know, The glory of knowing the Lord is that he enters into grief with us, but there's also another glory, and that is to thank him for the good stuff, the life we have. When you enjoy what God has given you, and I know, and you know that sometimes you got a bunch of stuff, and he says, I'm going to lighten your load a little bit and bless you in some other ways and change your deal. Okay, all right, that's fine, and he does that. But none of this I hate physical life business, and that I'm not going to enjoy good sleep, good sex, enjoyable life that is legitimate within the holiness of God. None of this. It's false asceticism. God has given us eternal life, and he's not embarrassed of physical life on earth, though he's redeemed us from the sin. Learning how to think this way, how to live this way, will help us to understand when Jesus said, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, take my yoke upon you. My load is easy and my burden is light. You'll find rest for your souls. He was talking to people who had been absolutely beaten down with religious stuff. And Jesus said, come to me. I'll tell you how to live. And it's a good way to live. It's a gracious way to live. And you'll be an infinitely better witness at that point if you let him have this kind of impact at every level. Time's up. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you for reminding us of these things. Thank you, Lord, for challenging us to think biblically about areas that sometimes have suffered from neglect, especially for those of us who've been married for years, perhaps, and life in this area of our life has been neglected. We ask, Lord, that you would please grant to us healing and wisdom, refreshment in these areas, and the ability to live boldly, graciously, learning the skills of wise life, even at the level of sexual life, so that we can bring honor to you and correctly represent your word and the gospel to a culture that is dying without it. We trust you, Lord, and we thank you for these things. In Jesus' name, amen.